from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Japan's Prime Minister demands Islamic State release its hostages. World leaders discuss global cooperation against terror. A preview of historic U.S.-Cuban talks. And Obama in his State of the Union address is to highlight new cybersecurity proposals.
What happens if somebody hacks your checking account and you wake up one morning and your balance is zero?
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Japan's government is vowing not to give in to terrorism after Islamic State militants released a videotape threat to kill two Japanese citizens held hostage. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
A man clad in black and speaking with a British accent says on a video posted online that unless $200 million is paid to his group, two Japanese men will be executed. The knife-wielding man is seen standing in between the two Japanese who are clad in orange jumpsuits and are kneeling on the desert ground. The man says unless Japan pays the money within 72 hours, this knife will become your nightmare. Just hours after the video's release, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, on a visit to the Middle East, was defiant, issuing a strong demand for the release of the Japanese men. Speaking to reporters in Jerusalem, Mr. Abe says the demand to pay ransom in exchange for the lives of the hostages is unforgivable. The prime minister adds that Japan will not give in to terrorism. Mr. Abe, during a visit to Cairo Saturday, as part of a $2.5 billion Middle East aid package, pledged $200 million in non-military assistance for countries fighting against the Islamic State. Japan is not among the countries participating in the coalition battling insurgents in Syria and Iraq. However, Japanese citizens have previously been killed by Islamic militants. The most notable attack was at an Algerian gas plant in 2013, when 10 Japanese died. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
European Union leaders are calling on Arab countries to join their efforts against terrorism. On Monday in Brussels, EU foreign ministers discussed international cooperation in tracking members of terrorist sleeper cells. The head of the Arab League also attended. Zlata Zahok reports for VOA Television.
Muslims in many countries continue protests against French cartoons ridiculing the Prophet Muhammad and those who support the satire they deem offensive. Thousands of people gathered in the southern Russian region of Chechnya Monday to rally against French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, whose staff members were killed earlier this month after publishing such cartoons. Protesters marched through the streets of downtown Grozny, condemning the satirists. Chechnya's pro-Moscow leader Ramzan Kadyrov called on fellow Muslims to resist provocation.
We are telling the world that Muslim people won't allow themselves to be used for destabilizing the situation in our country. We have always been reliable defenders of Russia, and today we can stand against any enemy of our country.
European countries have boosted security and are working to track down terrorist cells and their connections abroad in the wake of the Paris terrorist attacks that killed 17 people. A French police official said the country needs to modernize its technology to keep up with terrorists.
French criminal databases are a decade behind. Why? Because the databases are not interactive. They are not accessible by different police departments. They are not regularly updated. You have the data that shouldn't be there, and you have other data that is missing.
Terrorist attacks have killed more people in majority Muslim countries than in the West. The European Union has asked Arab League countries to join forces with Europe in fighting terrorism.
As the threat is not only the one we faced in Paris, but also spreading in many other parts of the world, starting from Muslim countries, and we need to strengthen our way of cooperating together.
The Arab League Secretary General said the organization will help efforts to undermine radical ideologies, but he made clear it will not join military efforts to fight Islamist militants.
The Arab League does not get into alliances. The Arab League has no desire to use arms. We are talking about a comprehensive confrontation, philosophical, economic, religious, media, educational, in schools. All these have to be confronted, and we are taking part in this. We have nothing to do with the military side.
The World Economic Forum will discuss risks of terror at its annual meeting in Davos next week.
Terror cannot be combated on a national basis. It needs international cooperation.
Forum founder Klaus Schwab said leaders must work on better coordination of their actions to prevent terror. Zlatica Hoc, VOA News, Washington.
Russia has tried to launch a new initiative to mediate a peaceful solution to the Syrian civil war. The plan was to host peace talks between the Syrian government and the Syrian opposition in Moscow on January 26th. It would have been the first on Syria since a UN-sponsored conference in Geneva collapsed early last year after making no headway. But the Russian effort appears to be unraveling as prominent Syrian opposition figures shun the prospective negotiations, citing deep distrust of Moscow and concerns the talks hold no chance of success. George Sabra is president of the Syrian National Council, the main opposition group in Syria. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy asked him for his opinion of the Russian initiative.
I'm sorry to say there is no initiative. Nothing deserves in Moscow to be initiative. It's only an idea, invitation for some people without any schedule, without any timetable, only asking opposition group to come and talk whatever they want to talk. Believe me, this is not the first time for the opposition to meet each other. We have met in Cairo 2 years ago, and we have a united message to the international community. Also in Geneva, too, a year ago, the opposition met the regime, and nothing happened. What will happen new in Moscow? Nothing. So we are, as a part of the opposition, I mean the coalition, refused to go to Moscow.
How important is to secure a support of regional players like Iran and the Gulf countries as they turn the Syrian crisis into a proxy war between them?
It's important for us to share Iran, Russia, and all countries in the region and in the international community. But as a moderator, you have to be ready to play that role. Iran right now, we are as Syrians consider Iran as an enemy and supporting our enemy, because Syrian regime couldn't kill us without supporting of Russia and Iran especially. And I want to remind you with Iranian militia which crossed the border to Syria from Lebanon, I mean Hezbollah, and from Iraq with the decision from Al-Haris al-Thawri in Iran, Revolution Guard, ruled by Qasem Soleimani. So if Iran didn't change the position against Syrian people, we can't accept any role to Iran.
George Sabra, president of the Syrian National Council, the main opposition group in Syria.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
U.S. officials preparing to open historic talks with their Cuban counterparts Wednesday in Havana will discuss upgrading diplomatic relations and lifting travel restrictions following a December 17th announcement aimed at ending more than 50 years of hostility. The U.S. delegation will become the first to meet with its Cuban counterparts in Cuba in nearly four decades. Ted Henkin, a Cuba analyst at Baruch College in New York and author of three books on Cuba, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, upgrading diplomatic ties and migration are complex issues that may not be resolved quickly.
The migration issue is very important and very complex, but it's something that the governments have actually been talking about a lot. That's one of the few things they've been communicating about going back a number of years, given the proximity of both countries and given the fact that there's been over the last 20 years, but especially over the last 3 or 4 years, a rising number of Cubans who have been intercepted at sea, who have made unauthorized dangerous voyages to the United States. And also the Cubans often will complain that that is something that is encouraged by the special treatment that Cubans get, sometimes referred to as the wet foot, dry foot policy. Also, as we move towards establishing diplomatic relations, there's going to be a question whether that special treatment will continue. And there are U.S. fugitives in Cuba who the United States would like back, and the United States would probably like to send to Cuba a number of people in the United States of Cuban origin who have been declared deportable, but they have not actually been deported, and this may be an opportunity to allow that to happen.
Cuba released some 53 dissidents at the request of the U.S. Were you surprised that they allowed them to go?
No, because I think that it was something that needed to be part of the package to show that they were amenable to, at least symbolically, making a shift on human rights. The question really about that isn't that they released these 53 political prisoners, but will they be harassed, rearrested, detained? Will their rights be respected in the future? And that's the real question going forward and the real test, I think, because that's going to be on the U.S. agenda to continue to press Cuba for respect for fundamental freedoms.
We haven't heard anything from Fidel Castro, the former Cuban leader, who's now approaching 90 years of age.
He has gradually faded into the background, kind of as a grandfather figure. He has made, kind of spurts of appearances over time, usually going on about international affairs that don't have to do with a lot of the domestic reforms in Cuba. He's probably holding his nose about some of those since they go against a lot of his examples. It is surprising since he made his reputation really on defying the United States, but I think it's two things. I think part of it is that he's kind of made a secret deal with Raul to, kind of shut up and get out of the way so Raul can make his own legacy. And Fidel would certainly overpower that with his legacy and personality if he got involved. But also I think that it's likely that Fidel is probably not capable of really coherently participating in policymaking, and that's probably why we don't see him, because the government probably doesn't want to show a frail, weak leader who was once the maximum leader.
Will this warming of ties between longtime rivals improve the U.S. standing in Latin America?
Certainly. That is, I think, probably the kind of ripple effect that we're going to see. Obama, when he gave his speech, said two key phrases in Spanish back on December 17th. He sent a message to the Cubans saying that he understands that no es fácil, it ain't easy surviving in Cuba, and he wanted to make it a little bit easier with these changes. But he also sent a message to the hemisphere, and he said, todos somos americanos, we are all American, reminding Latin Americans that he knows that we're neighbors and we're equals, and sometimes the perception is that the United States ignores Latin America, only pays attention when it's in its interest. And even though Cuba is not really that important, it does have a symbolic importance, and the United States has been isolated in its policy, and I think this is a way to reconnect. And it may even have the effect of getting some of the Latin American countries on board in the future when the U.S. is critical of human rights abuses on the island.
The U.S. delegation will be headed by Roberta Jacobson, Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, while Josefina Mivdal, a Foreign Ministries Director for U.S. Affairs, will head the Cuban delegation for the 2 days of talks. U.S. President Barack Obama will call for tax increases on the wealthiest Americans during the annual State of the Union address before a joint session of Congress, the first of his presidency completely dominated by opposition Republicans. Mr. Obama will call for raising taxes on profits individuals make from selling assets such as stocks, bonds, and real estate, ending tax breaks for inherited estates worth millions of dollars, and imposing a fee on the country's biggest financial firms. The president wants to use the revenues, estimated at $320 billion over the next 10 years, to offset tax breaks for middle-income Americans and for initiatives such as free tuition for community college students. The proposals have already been soundly rejected by Republican lawmakers who gained control of both the House and Senate after enjoying sweeping victories in last November's midterm elections. Despite the victories, Mr. Obama has vowed to veto a number of Republican priorities, including approval of a controversial oil pipeline from Canada to the U.S. Gulf Coast and changes to his signature health care reform law. President Obama, in his State of the Union address, is also expected to focus on several new cybersecurity and privacy proposals recently announced by the White House. The measures call for greater information sharing between the federal government and private companies and new security initiatives to prevent high-profile hacks. VOA technology correspondent Doug Bernard has details.
At a White House meeting recently with congressional leaders, President Obama said both parties could agree to strengthen cybersecurity. The recent attack at Sony Pictures and a hack of a Pentagon Twitter feed by supporters of the Islamic State group, he said, underscore the need to act.
It just goes to show how much more work we need to do, both public and private sector, to strengthen our cybersecurity, to make sure that families' bank accounts are safe, to make sure that our public infrastructure is safe.
While U.S. government computer systems are generally well protected, the same cannot be said of many private and corporate networks, says Daily Beast senior correspondent Shane Harris, putting at risk all kinds of data, from banking and credit records to email communications to control of the nation's electric grid.
We don't regulate internet security the way we regulate safety at, you know, chemical plants and food production facilities. We just don't do that. We might, but we're not doing that now.
In all, the White House has introduced three separate measures to combat cybercrime and strengthen privacy. The first, the Personal Data Protection and Notification Act, would require companies that handle data to alert customers if any of their private information had been compromised or stolen by hackers within 30 days. The measure has won strong backing by many retailers and other data companies. Denise Zhang, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, says that's because companies are already dealing with a costly and cumbersome patchwork of similar laws in different states.
There are currently 47 different states that have data breach notification laws already on the books. And what this bill would do is actually create some more regulatory certainty and a standard across the country.
Another proposal would encourage private corporations to voluntarily share certain types of information with each other and with the Federal Department of Homeland Security. But Harley Geiger, a senior counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology, says this measure could actually erode some consumer privacy protections while taking away individuals' access to the courts.
Where the administration's proposal leaves gaps is in privacy policies, that it actually relies rather heavily on privacy procedures that have not yet been written. The law would require them to be written, but since they have not been created, it is impossible to gauge whether or not they would actually be effective.
So far, congressional leaders have been mostly silent about whether they would support or oppose the president's initiatives. An earlier proposal to protect consumers from fraud and government intrusion failed in Congress last year. Cyber journalist Shane Harris says Mr. Obama's reference to protecting family bank accounts may, in fact, be the proposal's best selling point.
We talk a lot about credit card information being stolen, and it's very easy to get your credit card replaced. But what happens if somebody hacks your checking account and you wake up one morning and your balance is zero? If something like that were to start to happen, and that's something that's happened to corporations in this country, then you're going to see a level of public concern and alarm over this that could be very destabilizing.
Still, it's unclear how much pressure U.S. lawmakers will feel from the public to pass these measures. Doug Bernard, VOA News, Washington.
VOA's live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address begins at 1:30 Universal Time Wednesday. The president is currently enjoying a boost in popularity thanks to an improving economy, a falling unemployment rate, plummeting gas prices, and a series of policy achievements. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On January 20th, 1265, the first English Parliament was called into session by the Earl of Leicester. The new Parliament, a gathering that included commoners, was the result of a 13th century civil war. In 1783, preliminary articles of peace were signed in France, a document that led to the signing of the Treaty of Paris that formally ended hostilities in the American Revolutionary War. In 1841, it was announced that the British would be given control of the Chinese territory of Hong Kong. 6 days later, the Union Jack was hoisted over the territory. In 1925, a treaty was signed in Peking, normalizing relations between the Soviet Union and Japan. In 1942, Nazi officials held the infamous Wannsee Conference in Berlin, deciding on the extermination of European Jews, something they called the final solution. In 1961, at the age of 43, John Fitzgerald Kennedy was inaugurated as the youngest person ever elected to the U.S. presidency. During his famous inauguration address, Kennedy asked a new generation to go to work and make a better world.
Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
In 1986, for the first time, a federal holiday in the U.S. honored black civil rights leader Martin Luther King, Jr. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Much has changed in the three decades since HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, was identified. Even as recently as a decade ago, a diagnosis of HIV/AIDS seemed like a death sentence for an entire continent, said Secretary of State John Kerry. Back then, more than 2 million people died from AIDS-related causes on a worldwide basis. Today, we've cut those numbers by 34%. Back then, AIDS threatened to wipe out a whole generation, leaving behind 14 million orphans and vulnerable children. Today, we've slashed new infections among children in half. The tide has turned, said Secretary Kerry. We are fighting the disease, and an AIDS-free generation is in sight.
PEPFAR is now supporting life-saving antiretroviral drug treatment for 7.7 million men, women, and children. We're providing HIV testing and counseling to more than 14 million pregnant women. We're training more than 140,000 new healthcare workers to deliver HIV and other health-related services in AIDS-affected countries.
But the battle is not yet won, said Secretary Kerry. So the United States is intensifying the fight against this terrible disease and introducing new strategies. First, PEPFAR is collaborating with the Nike Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in a $210 million public-private partnership to achieve an AIDS-free future for adolescent girls and young women in up to 10 countries. Second, we will invest $116.5 million to strengthen the capacity of health workers to deliver life-saving HIV services and also help address other public health threats across Africa. Third, through the Accelerating Children's HIV/AIDS Treatment Initiative, PEPFAR, and the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, over the next 2 years, we will double the total number of children receiving life-saving antiretroviral treatment across 10 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. We are also working with our partners to accelerate the development of new pediatric medicines. Fourth, PEPFAR and the Millennium Challenge Corporation are partnering to invest $21.5 million toward creating country-driven local data hubs that will include data critical to controlling the epidemic, including health, poverty, and gender data, and will be used to improve strategic planning and quality of care. The United States' commitment to combating HIV/AIDS through PEPFAR and our long-standing support of the Global Fund is as undiminished as our work is unfinished. We can achieve an AIDS-free generation, said Secretary Kerry. We can and we will defeat this horrific disease.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.